everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Shuttlepod, the TrekMovie.com podcast. I am Kayla Iacovino, and I am joined by cohorts
Jared Whitley
and Brian Drew.
We are excited to be able to share the Shuttlepod with you guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. We appreciate all the feedback we've gotten from you guys in the comments section of our website and on Twitter or on our Facebook page. So please continue the conversation with us. We'd like to be able to share comments from the fans on air as it's appropriate. So thank you for participating in the conversation with us.
All right. And Brian, what are we going to talk about today?
We are going to talk about Harve Bennett, who, as many fans know, was the producer of The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, The Voyage Home, and The Unfortunate Final Frontier. Harve passed away a few days after Leonard Nimoy did this year, and due to the media coverage and everything else surrounding Leonard's death, I think Harve's passing got overlooked, and I thought that it would be nice to speak about Harve's career a little bit and what he accomplished in throughout his long life, not just in Star Trek, but in other things. And I basically wanted to really make mention of the fact that Harve probably saved the Star Trek franchise.
No question. No question at all. I mean, he had some help along the way, but he was definitely the captain of the ship at that point.
Absolutely. So I figured I would give everybody, you know, a little bit of background on Harve. When he was young, I think when he was probably in his early teens, maybe, he was one of the famous quiz kids, who are these young students who would go on radio shows and try to basically stump adults. They were very smart kids, intellectual kids that would, you know, go on these radio programs and have these discussions on a wide range of topics and answer questions competing against adults. And Harve was one of those.
So and that Harve would have been in the 1940s?
In the 40s, yeah. Yeah, Harve was no dummy. He, if you want to know more about the quiz kids in that whole era, there is a movie that came out in the early 90s that Robert Redford made that stars Rob Morrow from Northern Exposure that is well worth watching if this sort of thing interests you. I don't think Harve is in it anywhere, but it's an interesting movie nonetheless. Anyway, Harve, after, you know, he grew up, Harve was in the military for a while. And then once he completed his military service, he began his career, I believe, as a TV executive for ABC, and that's where he was for quite a while until, I think, in the late 60s when he went to work for Aaron Spelling and they made the TV show Mod Squad. I don't know if you guys know anything about that, but that was like a popular action-adventure kind of show in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. And that from there, his career began to take off, and he, throughout the 70s, produced a bunch of different things, TV shows, I believe movies of the week. And then he came upon the $6 million man. Exactly. The iconic 70s series starring Lee Majors. And many people may not know this, but in the opening sequence of the show, there's a line of dialogue that says, "Steve Austin, a man barely alive." And that voice is Harve Bennett's.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Can we get an audio clip of that, Brian?
Yes, I think we'll dig that up and we'll put it up for everybody so they can listen to it.
Fantastic.
So anyway, he had a lot of success with that show. That kind of made Harve more than anything, was a $6 million man. And then he produced the Bionic Woman spinoff that came a few years later. And, you know, basically Harve carved himself a nice career as a TV series, TV producer. And that's what he was known for when he came to the Paramount lot in, I believe, 1981. He signed a deal that called for him to produce a bunch of TV shows for Paramount. And while he was there, he got a call from, I believe, Michael Eisner, who was the president of Paramount at the time, and brought Harve into a room where Eisner was and Charlie Bluedorn, the head of Paramount, the owner of Paramount, and Barry Diller was there as well, and they quizzed Harve if he knew anything about Star Trek, and, you know, he did, and they asked him if he had seen Star Trek the Motion Picture, and he said he had, and they asked him what he thought of it, and he goes, "Well, to be perfectly honest, I thought it was boring." Which, obviously, I think a lot of people, not myself in particular, but a lot of people felt that way about the movie. Charlie Bluedorn said something to Harve along the lines of, "Well, you know, we would like to make more of these movies, and would you be interested in making them, and could you make them for less than $45 million?
Which that was a lot of money back then.
Well, yeah, I think at the time the movie came out, it broke the Guinness Book of World Records for the most money spent on a motion picture.
Oh, well.
Anyway, Harv said, oh, wow, I can make, you know, three movies for that. Because, you know, when you're a TV producer, you have to make a lot with a little.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about producing a TV show that's a little different than a movie is a lot of a movie's cost is like setup. Whereas if you produce a pilot, that all that setup is one time. I mean, you pay to create the 10 forward set one time, and then you can use it 100 times.
You can reuse sets and costumes and all that.
This is part of the idea of why so many movie franchises nowadays want to create like shared universes is they just set stuff up and then they follow that TV model and then they go, which is why like Marvel is able to make these movies less expensively than they would have been 20 years ago or whatever. Anyway, I digress.
Anyway, so they basically commissioned him to do it, and you know, I don't know if everybody even knows this part of it, but when the movie was originally commissioned, it was commissioned to be and began production out of Paramount's television division. They weren't even sure they were going to release it theatrically, The Wrath of Khan.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, I'd never heard that.
But they got far enough into the process where they liked what they were seeing and they decided to make it a feature.
I mean, what would it have been?
It probably would have been a movie of the week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or it would have been released in theaters, but it wouldn't have gotten the wide release it ended up getting.
Yeah.
It might have gotten, you know, like a B-movie type of release pattern or something like that.
Can you imagine what would have happened to Star Trek if they made one movie and then they made a movie of the week? Like, I feel like we wouldn't have had anything else.
No, that would have ruined it. Yeah, that would have been the end of it. Harv decided, you know, he wanted to go back to the flavor and the feeling of the original series and screened a bunch of episodes. And obviously, you know, we all know the story. Harv, you know, watched Space Seed and decided that that's what his story was going to be. He was going to bring Khan back and, you know, looking for revenge.
I want to read, if I can interject briefly, I'm looking at an interview Harv did on StarTrek.com a few years ago, and it says he watched all 70 episodes of Star Trek, and he said he found that one-third of the episodes were brilliant, one-third were good, and one-third were eh. And he says, but if you're batting .333 in baseball, you're a hell of a hitter. Mm-hmm. Then he says, somewhere along the way, I ran into the episode Space Seed, and it was like God had sent a present down to me.
That's awesome.
You know, of all the episodes of the original series, you know, I don't feel any of them quite that strongly, but I'm sure glad that he felt that strongly.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, without getting, you know, into too much detail, it was Harv who hired Nick Meyer, who, as I think as we all know, that's one of the most key decisions anybody's made in the history of the franchise was Nicholas Meyer.
Agreed. Yep.
So Harv was able to entice a very reluctant Leonard Nimoy to return to play Spock by basically offering to kill the character off on screen. And most actors can't resist that kind of an offer.
Sure. Especially
to play a beautiful death scene. So.
Yeah, especially an actor who has a chance to kill a character about whom he wrote, I am not Spock.
Right, right. And Leonard, I think, felt that he should bring some sort of closure. He didn't want to have Spock just flat out disappear. So I think he felt that that was the right way to go.
And it's kind of interesting. Like, we know with our perspective now that, oh, of course he comes back in the next one. And he directs it. Oh, and he directs the one after that, too. Oh, and he comes back in Next Generation or whatever. Right. If you watch Wrath of Khan, Spock is barely in it. Right? I mean, so much of the stuff that would have gone to Spock actually goes to Savick.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, they leave Spock in the Enterprise during the entire...
When they do the away mission to the Genesis planet.
Right. Anyway, I wanted to discuss, you know, how you guys feel about Harv and his contributions to the franchise. Because obviously Harv produced, you know, not just The Wrath of Khan, but three other Star Trek movies. And he left a mark on the franchise that is still being felt today.
I think so much of the original series and then motion picture is very intellectual, right? And Harv found a way of distilling the emotional part of that that is more that an American audience is more favorably inclined toward. He's sort of, I mean, like if you watch the Lord of the Rings movies, they did such a good job of distilling out like the friendship among the four hobbits, right? They sifted through a lot of the lore that's in those books, and they just found that emotional core. And I think Harve Bennett did the exact same thing with the Star Trek franchise. And I think his relationship, professional relationship with Nick Meyer, is the perfect example of a producer doing what he needs to make a director's job as easy as it could be. Because yep. the director, I don't think, has as much freedom to maneuver if he has to worry about the back behind the scenes stuff, like luring one of the actors to come back. And so I think Harve's contribution can't be overstated. If it weren't for him and for the team he put together, the franchise might have died in the early 80s.
Right. A lot of people like to give Nick Meyer all the credit for The Wrath of Khan, but Harve deserves at least as much of the credit for that movie's success as Nick, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think the reason he doesn't is because we're trained to see the director as so important, and we don't really understand a lot of ways what the producer does. And by we, I mean us as a broader audience of moviegoers.
The right. royal we.
The royal we. Yes, thank you, Kayla. I also want to interject on this line of conversation. I want to mention James Horner, who Nick Meyer brought in as well. Mm-hmm. And Meyer hired him, not Bennett. But the fact that Horner died this year as well is something that I think we need to memorialize and celebrate. Horner had such a profound input in terms of setting the tone of that more emotional core. Yeah. In terms of incorporating also these more naval themes.
Yeah, it was very much the Horatio Hornblower that Gene talked about as his inspiration for Captain Kirk.
So if we look at Star Wars and we listen to the beautiful John Williams score, I don't think that movie would have worked if it hadn't had that. If it had been like cheesy disco music from the 70s, we would have forgotten it decades ago, right? And so Horner took that same idea of wanting to use a very classical sound. And, you know, Wrath of Khan came out in 82, so disco was only, you know, was still alive in some small fashion or another. And he said, okay, we need to make something that incorporates this sort of classical themes and sounds beautiful and timeless, but it can't sound just like Star Wars, right? It can't sound derivative of that. And I think he hit that mark beautifully. And if you look at Horner's career through the decades, I mean, this guy also scored Braveheart, and I think he won an Oscar for that. He scored just dozens of
Apollo 13.
Movies. Apollo 13. He did the Harrison Ford, Jack Ryan movies, and then he also, of course, did he did Titanic, and then he did Avatar.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was when we were writing the memorial for James Horner, I was looking through all the tweets from celebrities, and Zoe Saldana, you know, singles him out for thanks for what you did to make Avatar so great. And I forgot, oh yeah, of course, there's two Trek people who are working on that together. And so I thought that was a touching connection between the two of them. So, Bennett was not a musician, but music is obviously a critical part of a movie, of a right. cinematic franchise like this. And it's just another sign of what a great team he put together, of what a great, I think I said captain was the example I used before, but right. he put together a fantastic team.
Another thing maybe people don't know, and going back to what I was saying earlier about how the movie was originally going to be produced out of the TV division, originally Paramount wanted them to use a synthesizer score for the movie.
Seriously?
Seriously.
The Search for Spock?
No, The Wrath of Khan. And Nick Meyer fought back to get an orchestral score for the movie.
Like, can you imagine? Some, MIDI files? Like, what were they?
I don't know what the hell they were going to do, it was not going to be a classically composed piece of music.
They wanted it to be futuristic or something, I guess.
Yeah, maybe more along the lines of what Tangerine Dream did in Blade Runner or something like that. I don't know.
Have you guys seen the movie Lady Hawk? It came out in 1985. It's this medieval adventure movie, mm-hmm. But it has synthesizers providing the music in the background, yeah. and it makes it kind of unwatchable.
Amazing.
Yeah, but that's the kind, whenever, you know, I think of that as an example of what could have happened to some of these science fiction movies that they could have. I mean, because so much 80s music is like, oh, the synthesizer is new. Let's do this and Flight of Seagulls. And oh, it's so futuristic sounding. And it just sounds awful.
Look, right. guys, if it weren't for Harve Bennett and Nick Meyer, instead of The Wrath of Khan, we could have gotten Star Trek Lady Hawk.
Whoa.
Just saying.
It feels like I just bit into aluminum foil. What an awful taste. It's in my mouth.
So, I mean, but he also worked, I mean, it's not just the Wrath of Khan, which was what most people, I mean, it's generally agreed upon as the best of all the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, right. And certainly with that, along with Search for Spock and Voyage Home, mm-hmm. are kind of, in my house growing up, we referred to it as the Holy Trinity.
The, like, trifecta of the best. Yeah.
The Genesis trilogy.
The Genesis trilogy, yeah. And so what was his role sort of ongoing? What was his motivation in wanting to ask Leonard to direct the third movie instead of asking Nick to come back?
Well, I don't think that was really an option. I don't think anybody expected initially after The Wrath of Khan came out that Leonard was going to want to direct. I think if you believe his account, he kind of came up with the idea on the fly. I don't know if I believe that or not, but that's what he claims. Nick Meyer was not interested in returning. He didn't believe in, as he has said in many places, he goes, I don't know how to resurrect somebody. That's outside of my my life experience. He goes, I don't know anything about resurrection. So he goes, I'll step aside. Amazing. He was not happy. He was not happy about the reshoots at the end of The Wrath of Khan where you see Spock's tube on Genesis.
Oh, interesting.
That was done by Harv over Nick's objections.
So when was that actually decided?
Which part?
The reshoots that you're talking about.
They did a preview screening, I think, at Paramount, and at the end of the movie, like, you know, without that ending, the movie just kind of ends with the Enterprise pulling away from Genesis, and it had kind of this heavy feeling to it.
Right, it's just like Spock is dead. Bye.
Right, Spock is dead, and Spock is dead, and it kind of like really like cast like a funeral pall over the screening. And Harv said he got freaked out at the end of it because like people simply were not like cheering or anything.
See, and that was the right decision because the whole idea of Scotty playing the bagpipes of that turning into a full orchestral swell of Amazing Grace and showing him land on the Genesis planet, you know, with this new world that our friend gave his life to nourish or something. I can't remember it exactly. Like, you just need that. You need to end on that bright, cheerful note.
You really do.
So he made the absolute right decision.
Right. And then they had Leonard do the Space to Final Frontier voiceover too.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, that's why Nick Meyer was not an option for the Search for Spock. And then, you know, Leonard wanted to get another career going, and he knew that they were going to want him back as Spock. They weren't going to kill the franchise. The Wrath of Khan was a pretty big financial success for the studio, so they wanted to do another movie. So he took advantage of the situation, and I know that Harv kind of hovered over him throughout the entire shoot of the Search for Spock. But, you know, Leonard proved he had the chops, and it launched him a very successful directing career. And Harv wrote The Search for Spock from page one to the end.
Wow.
Oh, really?
And according to Harv, he wrote backwards. He wrote the scene with Kirk and Spock at the end of the movie when, you know, Jim, your name is Jim.
Yeah.
He wrote that first and then wrote backwards to get to that point.
Huh. I didn't realize that.
Meyer then came back to help write The Voyage Home.
Oh, before we move on from Search for Spock, I hope at some point we'll do an episode about each of the different movies. Our website is called Trek Movie. And I think The Search for Spock is the most influential Trek movie of all of them. If you look at the tone it sets in terms of the friendship and then the depiction of the Klingons and the Vulcans, I think that became the blueprint for virtually everything else that happened in the Star Trek franchise until First Contact.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think you're onto something there, man. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, and we can go into more detail. But just in terms of his writing, I think the most quintessential, best Star Trek moment to me of all time is when Kirk comes into McCoy and he does the Live Long and Prosper and he says, how many fingers am I holding up? I just love that joke because, you know, his friend is in a lot of pain and his friend is kind of, you know, this very sarcastic guy. And so he's like, okay, I'm going to give him some of his own medicine.
Yeah, Kirk totally was messing with him. Absolutely.
Yeah, and the fact that we have that going on at the same time as as Sulu picking the you know he has to beat up the guy who calls him Tiny.
Yeah.
I just think that's a magnificent scene. And McCoy
calling Spock a green-blooded son of a bitch.
It's his revenge. It's his revenge for all those arguments he lost to me.
Yeah, I mean, tell me that's not great stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the best, one of the best written scenes in the whole franchise.
Well, right? and that movie also has that scene with Spock and McCoy when McCoy tells Spock that he missed him and he doesn't know if he could ever stand to lose him again.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, that's another great moment in the franchise's history.
Well, it shows how well he knew the characters and their histories.
Yeah.
And not just how well he knew them, but how well he knew what people liked about them.
Yeah.
Harv is a very bright, perceptive man.
And I think it helped so much that he came from an outsider's perspective that he was able to identify those things in a way that someone who'd, you know, if it had been someone who'd been involved with the franchise for a long time, they might have either taken it for granted or they might have wanted to move on to something else, maybe, and explore other parts of that universe or their own intellectual curiosities.
Right. Well, he went in a very different direction than Gene probably would have gone.
Very different. Very different.
Right. And we could mention, too, that there's been some accounts through the years that Gene got pushed aside after the motion picture. He was blamed for the failure of the movie. He was blamed for the budget getting out of control. He was blamed for it underperforming. He was blamed for a lot of stuff, some of which he was responsible for, and other things probably weren't fair.
I also think, in terms of things not being fair, I think the studio looked at that, and very much like the studios do nowadays, and they said, we want this to perform as well as Star Wars. And when it didn't, they blamed him.
But that was like, part of it. Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Gene was known for being a huge pain in the ass.
I'm sure it was. Like,
so anyway, when they kicked him out of they gave him his executive consultant title. They paid him very well to do nothing, and Harv basically became Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah,
and I know Gene resented some of what Gene considered structural changes that Harv made to the franchise. You know, he didn't like that Spock was killed off. He leaked, according to Harv, Gene leaked that Spock was going to die in the movie.
Really?
Which was supposed to be... Harv believes to this... Well, up until he passed away, Harv believed that Gene leaked that.
How wide was the leak? I mean, was this in the press? Like, fans before they saw the movie
leaked,
knew about
he leaked it?
It.
He leaked
the
it.
Fans pissed off at him.
Yeah, exactly. He leaked it to the fanzines, apparently, because fanzines were a huge thing in those days.
Then the
mainstream press picked it up, and then it became a thing.
So people knew that was going to happen before they saw the movie.
Yeah.
Which is a spoiler of the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it caused a huge problem. The fans took out an ad in Variety or something threatening to not see the movie and all this other stuff. And it became a big deal.
A lot of people probably noticed, but that's why they shot the Kobayashi Maru the way they did. So with Spock, quote-unquote, dying along with the rest of the crew
at the beginning.
Captain Savick gets attacked by the Klingons. Right. So that fans would see that and say, oh, he didn't really die. He just pretended to die here at the beginning.
Right.
And then they could just sit back and enjoy the rest.
Right. It's very disarming. It's a very disarming thing when they do it right away like that and then pretend, oh, it's just a joke.
But then it also works very thematically because we see Kirk's like cavalier attitude toward life and death.
Right.
And then at the end, he's like, holy crap, people actually die when I'm not a good captain.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit to the voyage home then. Something that I really appreciated about the voyage home is Meyer didn't come back to direct it. Of course, Leonard directed it, but Meyer contributed to the writing, and he and Harv, they split it up where Bennett wrote all the stuff in the quote-unquote future, and Meyer wrote all the stuff in 1986, which seems like a great way to divide writing assignments, and I think works seamlessly.
Well, then you get those two different styles to set the time periods apart.
Yeah. Along with that weird kind of Russian science fiction sequence where we see all their heads to indicate they're traveling.
Oh, right. That is so weird. Yeah, which one of them wrote that then?
I don't know.
From what I understand, that was Leonard, actually.
Yeah, that had to be the director that came up with that.
Yeah, that was Leonard's thing. And like that's also one of the first, I believe, CGI... I mean, obviously, The Wrath of Khan was the first Star Trek movie on CGI, but that's all CGI. Then when their heads morph into one another,
oh, of course, yeah.
And in 1986, that was heavy duty stuff, guys.
Cool stuff, yeah.
The cast had to go in and get their faces scanned, and like this whole big thing. And in those days, that was very exotic.
I mean, it was a cool technological thing, but when people saw it, weren't they like, "What? what is happening right now.
Yeah, I know I was. I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. Because that's my reaction whenever I see that scene. I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot about this.
That's one of those things where I saw it when I was a kid. Oh, sorry, what's that?
It's like this acid trip all of a sudden.
Well, you know, I hear he did a lot of LDS back in the 60s.
That's true.
Sorry. I love that line. Okay, so the voyage home. What are some more of the significant contributions that Harv made to
the voyage home, which is, you know, widely regarded as
one of the more successful, more well-beloved installments in the franchise?
It's just a very sweet, lighthearted movie that has a message in it, but it doesn't beat you over the head while it's doing it.
It's also a message that
that saved the whales.
Has aged well, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he could have picked some other issue that would have been like, yeah, okay, well, that was the thing in the 80s, right? Because it was his decision to make it a lighthearted sort of comedy piece, right?
I think he and Leonard decided that they wanted to do something much more lighthearted. You know, after two movies that were basically about death and sacrifice, you kind of had to, like, you know, lighten everything up a little bit. And, you know, originally that movie was supposed to have Eddie Murphy in it.
Oh, yeah, he was going to be the Dr. Jillian character.
Yeah, he would have been the Jillian Taylor type character. They had a very different script at one point, and then, you know, for a variety of different reasons, Eddie decided not to do the movie, and they reconfigured the script, and then they cast Catherine Hicks.
Who I think did a beautiful job.
Yeah, I like Catherine Hicks in that role a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last year at the convention, they had a panel of particularly notable Trek guest stars, and it was her and John Shuck, who played the Klingon ambassador in that, and who also
love John Shuck.
He's terrific. I just wanted to talk to him about being in MASH.
Yeah, but,
you know, that's not what people wanted to hear.
He was painless.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. And then also Moriarty. There's the three of them. And someone asked Dr. Jillian about what her experience was like with that, and if she ever compared it to the guy who played Decker in the motion picture, because they were both on that TV show
Seventh Heaven.
If they ever reflected on it, and she said, "Well, his experience was very different than mine." Which was her way of saying, I got to be on a great movie that everyone loved, and he got to be on one that maybe he didn't like quite so much.
Aww. It's also worth noting that since you brought up the Star Trek convention last year, there were two separate cosplays of Dr. Jillian Taylor.
Yeah.
Which was beautiful.
That were both amazing.
That. Yeah, I really like that. And it took me a couple seconds to catch it, and then that's just one of those things you see and you have to smile because you're like, I'm so glad that I get to share this with this wonderful community of fans.
And speaking of Star Trek The Voyage Home cosplays, I think my favorite cosplay of the con last year, because it was so simple and pure, was the guy, I don't remember the character's name. It's the guy in the transparent aluminum factory.
Yeah.
And he has this like badge that says like, I quit smoking or something like that. Yeah. And like, it's just like this guy basically wearing like glasses, a beige cardigan thing, and that patch, and he walked around with an old Mac mouse that he could hold up and be like, "Hello, computer."
Yeah, that was my favorite costume.
Yeah, me too. That wins costume of the year.
See, he just needed someone to dress up as Madeline.
That's right.
Not now, Madeline.
Not now. Yeah. the perfect cosplays are those that are just so simple. And
oh, and yeah, how much money did he spend on that? I would guess $10 at a thrift store.
Yeah.
Another thing about the voyage home is that it ended up until, it's one of the most highest grossing of all the Star Trek movies. It had a huge crossover audience. It wasn't just Star Trek fans that went to see it.
I think it was the highest grossing until 2009.
No, TMP was the highest grossing until 2009. Yeah. Adjusted for inflation and all that, yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean just in terms of raw numbers.
Oh, raw numbers? Yes, it was. It was.
And what a risk. What a risk to make that decision, to make as simple a movie as it was. In fact, one time I was talking to some friends of mine, some of my nerd friends, and one of them was complaining about how science fiction movies usually are just like an excuse for action movies. They're just action movies with science fiction paint on it. And he said, name one movie from the last 30 years that's a science fiction movie that doesn't have laser guns. And I said, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Yep.
There's only one shot of a phaser the entire movie. Yeah, I felt pretty good about that. But of course, I didn't gloat because we don't do that. We've evolved beyond the need for gloating.
That's right. Well, along with getting rid of despair.
Oh, along with despair. We've evolved beyond that.
But, you know, Jared, you bringing that up is another good example of how Harv got Star Trek.
Yeah.
He understood it. And also, the other thing to remember about that movie, there is no bad guy.
That's right. There isn't. I mean,
technically, the human race is the bad guy in that movie.
Sure, sure. Our own short-sightedness.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whoever said the human race was logical.
I just love how she delivers that line. Like, she's so, like, whoever said the human race was logical.
Yeah, like she and Spock are just playing volleyball, and she just sets it for them perfectly.
And I like the way she looks at him when she finally realizes what he's wearing. Uh-huh.
See, look at this. Look how quotable this movie was. How beautifully it was written.
Oh man, we could quote that. Yeah, we can do. We can quote this movie a lot.
Yeah. Hmm. So the first time Kayla and I met in real life, I was out visiting the San Francisco Bay Area, and because I was visiting some friends in Palo Alto and realized she lived just, you know, like 20 minutes away, and so we were able to visit. And afterwards, I said, "Well, I'm here in town. I got to go visit the nuclear vessels in Alameda." And so there actually is, like, it's the USS Hornet. It was, like, this World War II craft, a battleship that you can go visit in Alameda. However, it is not nuclear-powered. So we have to debunk that one myth.
But there was.
And that wasn't the Enterprise, by the way, either.
There wasn't the time. No, it's not. Yeah, it wasn't, the Enterprise was not there.
Right, but that was in the movie, even though they said it was the Enterprise, that's not the Enterprise. I forget what aircraft carrier it was, but that was not the Enterprise.
I'm sure we can look it up. Oh, also, before we get too far, if someone hasn't already written in the comment section, yes, Kirk does fire his phaser at one point in the voyage home. He shoots the door to lock in the doctors when Chekhov is being operated on.
Right, and Chekhov does try to fire his phaser.
Oh, that's right, but the radiation stops.
But it must be the radiation.
Must be the radiation, yeah. Okay, well, we could get stuck on this all night. Let's move on to the Final Frontier. Now, this was, you see, the thing that I compare this to is like parliamentary politics in England. Like in the United States, you can have a president who serves two terms and then he's done, right? Whereas in England, or Great Britain, excuse me, you serve as the your party's like leader until your party gets voted out of office. So every prime minister in England like ends on a sour note. Just by default. And so this is kind of what happened with him on The Final Frontier. Is that accurate or is that inaccurate?
Well, with Shatner, you mean?
No, with Shatner directing, but with Harv Bennett as producer. Because that was his last one. He didn't return for Undiscovered Country.
No, but he was going to. I mean, that's a whole separate discussion. Harv didn't really want to produce Star Trek V, apparently because he and Leonard had had a great deal of problems, I should say. While they were shooting four.
Personal problems?
Yeah, apparently they got really ugly at some points. And, like, Harv was kind of done and didn't want to come back.
Oh, I never heard that.
Oh, yeah. No, they ended up becoming friends again later on. But for a while there, it was apparently not good at all. Anyway, so he really didn't want to come back and produce another movie. He didn't like the story idea that Shatner had. But apparently, you know, Bill prevailed upon him to the point where he finally consented to do the movie. But he really, it didn't seem like his heart was really in it. And, you know, you could kind of see why.
Yeah. He wasn't.
I mean, the movie's got a lot of problems that have, you know, that movie has so many problems.
However, one of the things that I would say in defense of that is certainly in the first act, a lot of that heart and the friendship among the different characters is definitely there.
Oh, yeah.
The scenes at Yosemite, where they're you know, talking about row, row, row your boat and roasting marshmallows and stuff. That's beautiful Star Trek right there.
I agree.
And you know, things like, you know, men like us don't have families, right? And of course, because they're manufactured family.
Right.
So that part, I think, still came through pretty strongly.
Oh, the movie's heart is in the right place. There's no question. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about Star Trek V.
We should.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure we will.
Oh, well, the one thing, of course, germane to this conversation that we need to mention is that Harv Bennett actually appears on screen in Star Trek V.
Right, he's Admiral Bob, I believe his name is.
Admiral Bob.
That's right.
Admiral Bob.
I think on Memory Alpha they credit him as Admiral Bennett, but I could be wrong.
But he's called Bob on screen.
That's right, he calls him Bob.
And it was a first name Bob.
Well, that's to show how Kirk is sort of, he transcends rank, right? He can call admirals Bob.
Exactly. Well, he was a former admiral himself. You know, he was part of the fraternity.
Yeah, he'd been in the club. One thing I absolutely love in that exchange is where Admiral Bob is assigning him, and he says the Enterprise is a disaster. There's got to be other ships you can send. He says it doesn't matter the Enterprise. What matters is the captain. We need Jim Kirk. And you hear Kirk say on his side of the conversation, "Oh, please."
Right. That's like what you call false modesty, though.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, you can tell that William Shatner doesn't feel that. But I do like the idea of Kirk rolling his eyes at an admiral trying to butter him up for a mission that he should not be sent on.
Totally. Anyway, you know, that movie was what it was. It underperformed. It endangered the movie franchise.
Yeah.
It was what it was. I mean, like I said, there's a whole – we can go on a whole tangent about that movie and – Yeah, it wasn't one thing that went wrong with that movie. It was a lot of different things.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, that was something that we can point out quickly is that one of the reasons why Star Trek IV had such a huge crossover appeal is because the movie was largely a comedy.
Yep.
And when Paramount saw how it went over so well, they wanted more of that in the following movie because, hey, now we can get, you know, more than the Trekkies to come see these movies. Sure. So, you know, let's get more of that. Let's do more of that. And, you know, Scotty walking into a bulkhead and, mm-hmm. you know, Sulu and Chekhov getting lost.
One of the things to note about the comedy that is injected into Final Frontier is all of it comes at the expense of William Shatner's co-stars.
Yep.
Except I do like the line, please, Captain, not in front of the Klingons. I thought that was funny.
Well, most of the bad comedy is among the supporting cast. He doesn't do anything to Leonard and DeForest.
No.
Mostly, you know, his feelings about the supporting cast sort of come out in the movie inadvertently.
Yep. And I enjoyed that movie more when I was younger before I realized that was there.
Aww.
Yeah.
At this point, it's kind of hard to divorce it from it. Anyway, but sticking to Harb Bennett, so why didn't he come back for Undiscovered Country?
Okay, so Star Trek V finishes. You know, obviously there's a potential danger that the movie franchise might be in an end with the original cast. Blah 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 blah. I certainly thought it was endangered after I walked out of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Harv decided, the cast was getting older and more expensive with every movie that they were making. So Harv came up with an idea of doing basically a soft reboot. And he came up with this whole Starfleet Academy idea where we were going to see Kirk and Spock, and I think McCoy too, during their time at Starfleet Academy. I don't think we were ever going to see, they weren't going to end up on the Enterprise at the end of the movie. Like, they were going to have the original cast, they were going to have Kirk and Spock at the beginning of the movie, Shatner and Nimoy, and at the end of the movie, and they were going to do a flashback, they were going to talk about, when they went to school, how they first met, and all this other stuff. And that's how they were going to basically launch the Starfleet Academy concept as the new version of Star Trek.
So a way to continue the life of the franchise with less expensive actresses.
Correct. I think Harv was talking to Ethan Hawke about playing young Kirk, and it got
interesting.
It got far enough where they had a script, and there is production concept art that you can look up.
Oh,
that's
wow.
out there. It got fairly far, but ultimately. First of all, the cast, when they caught wind of it, got very upset for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
They were not thrilled with the idea, especially the supporting cast.
Sure, for whom that was their meal ticket.
Right. And then, more important than anything, apparently, the 25th anniversary of the franchise was approaching, and the head of Paramount at the time, was in a production meeting with a bunch of other executives, and he says to the executives, what have we got coming up, on the slate for next year? And they tell him, we've got, a new Star Trek movie coming out. But they were planning on making it, we're very proud of. Okay, cool. Are Bill and Leonard happy with the script? And the executives had to tell him, no, they're barely in it. He goes, what do you mean they're barely in it?
Oh, wow.
And that's when this guy found out, his name is Martin Davis, I believe. Once he found out that they were going to try to do this reboot right in the middle of a huge merchandising opportunity, like the 25th anniversary, he's like, yeah. No. Forget it. He goes, we need a movie with the original cast.
Hmm.
So they go back to Harv and say, listen, we still like your idea, but we would like you to produce one more movie with the original cast. And apparently, Harv was, first of all, very disappointed that the project got canceled. And then he felt like there was not enough time to come up with a concept and get the movie out in time for the 25th anniversary. So apparently, you know, there was a certain bit of certain falling out, and Harv walked away. So that's why he did not produce Star Trek VI.
See, and you know, as much as we've gone on glowingly about what an awesome contribution he had to the franchise, Star Trek VI didn't seem to suffer for his absence. I mean, it's pretty terrific.
Yeah, well, Leonard kind of took over Harv's role of supervising everything.
And at that point, he was more experienced in the production side of things. So he could do more of this kind of stuff on his own.
Right, right. So Harv, unfortunately, you know, his time with the franchise came to an end in a kind of ignominious way, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it's also sad, like, I mean, he never got to, like, guest write an episode of Next Generation or anything like that.
No, I don't know if he had any interest or, you know, if it was even a discussion.
Oh, would have been fun to see him do something with that, though. I mean, especially given that his history was in television science fiction.
Yeah, no, it would have been interesting to see if he could have blended into that TNG universe. He probably would have been just fine.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there was that initial sort of old guard in the first two seasons of TNG, and then in the third season, that's when it really became the series that we know it as.
Right.
And so there was definitely a churn, right, where they could have brought in different talent.
Mm-hmm. Right. But at the time, I think that's when Harv was still kind of attached to the original cast and stuff like that. It was a different time. It was
definitely.
But anyway, like, you know, like I said, his time came to an end very abruptly, but that doesn't take away from the fact that he got Star Trek back off the ground.
Absolutely.
Gave us some incredible, you know, some really memorable moments that are legendary within the history of the franchise. And for that, we thank him.
Absolutely. Brian, he was active in convention circles for years afterwards. Did you ever see him in a convention?
I never saw Harv, no.
Oh, too bad.
No, which is too bad. I would have liked to. But yeah, he definitely hit the circuit for a while, but I think his health had been deteriorating the past few years, which is why he hadn't been around much. I mean, Kelly, he probably been... Do you ever see him at any conventions?
Not that I can recall, no.
Yeah, no, I think he kind of maybe did conventions for a few years after his time ended with the franchise, and I think he kind of slowly weaned himself off of it to the point where I think he wasn't even living in Los Angeles anymore when he passed away. I think he was living in Oregon or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He kind of just packed it in and, you know, called it a career, I think.
Mm. Well, you know, we all need to ride into the sunset at some point.
Indeed.
And speaking of which, as we're closing this out, we've been eulogizing Harv Bennett, and we made mention of James Horner as well. This year, of course, we also lost Grace Lee Whitney, and so we just want to mention, and Bruce Hyde as well.
Yeah, it's been a rough year.
It's been a rough year, and so, you know, we're glad to have them as part of this wonderful following of ours, and we're sad to see them go, and may the great bird of the galaxy carry their spirits to wherever they need to go.
Indeed.
So say we all.
Wrong franchise.
I know, but it's so good. It's so good.
We like the sentiment, Jared. It's good.
Thank you.
I think it's great that we're taking the time to look back at what Harv has done. I've, for one, learned quite a bit about his contributions just in this conversation and talking with you guys previously. But I think it's key that, at least it seems to me that Trek was in such a vulnerable place when he came in. And so Brian and Jared at the beginning, you both mentioned, you know, Harv can be credited with saving Star Trek. And I think that's certainly true, because you can imagine you had this three season long television series in the 60s and one movie at the time. So there was it wasn't guaranteed to continue on. Like today we take for granted the fact that even if the next movie is a complete failure, Star Trek isn't done. It's a long-lived franchise. It's just pretty established by now. But at the time, no one knew where it was going to go, if it was going to continue to be a thing, if it was going to fizzle out. And so because of Harv Bennett and all these other people that he brought on board, you know, he can get a lot of the credit for keeping Star Trek alive in that vulnerable, crucial time when it was kind of a make or break for the franchise as a whole.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, looking to the future, to whatever Star Trek All Access eventually becomes called, I just hope that they find the next Harv Bennett and Nick Meyer, right? Whoever that is, I hope that they find those people and put them in charge, and they're able to usher in, you know, a new type of storytelling that is the same but different, and is able to carry the franchise into the future.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see who they bring on, right? Because right now it's Alex Kurtzman, basically, who is involved in the JJ movies. So
we would be lucky to get somebody like Harv.
We would.
Yeah.
Let's tie a ribbon on this and close it up. We it's a great opportunity to talk about, you know, an invaluable contributor to the Star Trek franchise, and we hope that all of you will be able to, when next time you rewatch Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock and the Voyage Home, that you'll be able to have a newfound appreciation for the stamp he left on the franchise's legacy.
Yep.
Key moment in Trek history.
Key moment. A clutch moment. And he just dove into second base head first like Pete Rose.
Yeah, it's remarkable in the history of this franchise when it's always been on the ropes. There's always been just the right person to come along and lift it up. So Harv is one of those people, and we salute him.
All right, so that's it for this episode of The Shuttle Pod. Thanks again, everyone, for tuning in, and please leave us your comments in the comments section on our website at trekmovie.com. Send us tweets, emails. Let us know what you guys think about the show, what you think about Harv Bennett and his contributions to Trek. We're looking forward to hearing from you. All right, this is everyone here from The Shuttle Pod podcast signing off. See you later.
Stronger, faster.